Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Q&A. I'm Jay Nordlinger, and this podcast is brought to you by X-Chair for exceptional sitting. I'll have more to say about our sponsor later in the show. Our guest today wears a number of hats. He's an international lawyer, a human rights activist, a writer. He is the executive director of United Nations Watch, UN Watch. He is the founding chairman of the Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy. He is Hillel Neuer, an old friend and comrade of mine. It's a pleasure to welcome him to the show. And I'm going to begin, Hillel, by asking you, where are you today? On what continent, for one? You have so many cities.
Right. Well, normally I'm based in Geneva, but today I'm in Jerusalem.
Well, it's very good to see you. And so you have two names that can be pronounced multiple ways. Hillel, Neuer, perhaps, in your native Montreal. I really don't know. Give us a little sketch of your two names. What do you say when speaking ordinary English with just a Michigan hick like me?
Well, I say my name is Hillel Neuer.
Right.
So that's how I pronounce the name. It's true that in Canada, most people, when they see it, they would think it's Neuer. So we also... will go in Canada as Neuer, but I've been in Geneva in Europe for the past 18 years. And so I got to revert back to the proper European pronunciation. So they have no problem with it. When I'm in Geneva and people see my name, Geneva is French speaking, but because Switzerland, the majority of Switzerland is German speaking. So enough people can figure it out. And that's my last name. And my first name is a Hebrew name, and it's named after a sage who lived around the time of Jesus, so it's about 2,000 years ago, and he's one of the great sages in the Jewish heritage, and he was a teacher, a rabbi. His name was Hillel. He was a person of modesty, of modest means, and he's most famous in the Talmud, among other things, for when a skeptic came to sort of provoke him and the other great sage of his time, whose name was Shammai, and he knocked on the door of Shammai, who was also a great teacher and rabbi. And he said, can you teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot, said the skeptic. And the Torah being the totality of Jewish teachings, Jewish knowledge. And Shammai was known to be kind of strict. And he would interpret the law in a strict way. And he said, according to the story, he told the skeptic, I'm busy. It's before Shabbat. And you're, badgering me with an impossible question to teach you the entire Torah, which there's volumes and volumes. And it's sort of this never ending sea of knowledge, and you're asking me to teach you while you stand on one foot in a moment. It's impossible, leave me alone. And then he did the same to Hillel. He knocked on Rabbi Hillel's house, on his door, and he asked Hillel the same question, and Hillel was busy, but he said, that which is hateful unto thee, do not do unto others. That is the entire Torah. All the rest is commentary. Go and learn. go and learn. So actually, as I'm saying it, and because you're someone, you're a writer and of a conservative bent, I don't know if Commentary Magazine was somewhat inspired by that line. Probably not. Mm-hmm. Probably not, because I don't think in 1945 they were thinking of Hillel, but maybe they were. All the rest is commentary, go and learn. And according to the story, the skeptic was so impressed by the patient answer and the way it was succinctly summed up all of Jewish teaching, and that he... because the final dictum was not just that which is hateful unto thee, do not do unto others, but that's all the rest is commentary, but go and learn, and that he went to study and learn the Hebrew alphabet, and then himself became a believer and so forth. So anyway, so that's who I'm named after. I'm named after Hillel, who's known for his patience and his tolerance and his wisdom, etc. So.
Well, then that's fitting. I don't know if the magazine Tycoon still exists, but when it did, they played on that. All the rest is commentary. That was a shot right. at Norman Podhoretz and the others that's at right. commentary. That's right.
That's right. Uh-huh. That was part of their ad. That's right.
Sounds like we're talking about the golden rule found in Leviticus and emphasized by
although
Jesus.
Although I guess it just framed, I guess, in a different way.
You are a Canadian, Hillel, and you're from Montreal. I'm never sure how to pronounce the novelist's name, Richler or Rickler?
Mordecai Richler.
Yeah. Did you grow up in the environment that is the setting of his novels? Did you grow up in that atmosphere of the Mordecai Richler novels? Or maybe that was over by the time you came along.
Yeah, it was. But I'm just laughing because I just showed to my little 10-year-old nephew a video clip. When I was a teenager of 14, I was in a Mordecai Richler film, a short film, which never, it was the version that never, it was never finally broadcast. The producers didn't like the way it was going, and they had another director and another cast. And it was a short story of his called Bambinger. I played a young boy in the 1940s, and we filmed for a week. And I have the sort of the raw cuts for 10 minutes. So just the other day, I was showing a Mordecai Richler short film. But to answer your question, he writes really about primarily the 1940s, maybe 30s and 40s, really 1940s. And so it's my father's time. So he writes about a time and a place that my father knows well. And of course, he has a very particular view on things. It's sort of he's looking at the seedier things. And it's not a world that, let's say, my father and his friends necessarily saw. He had particular glasses, but certainly the places and the milieu is generation. And I grew up in the 1970s, so different time.
Hillel, in Montreal, did the Noyers know the Krauthammers?
We did not. It's a good question. Some people that I know knew the family. He, Charles Krauthammer himself left probably around 1970. If you know his history, he did undergrad in Montreal. He was editor of the McGill Daily, and then he went to England. I think it was either at Oxford or Cambridge, I think, to do a PhD in political theory. And then he went to Harvard Medical School and all the rest. So he left around 1970, and I don't think very many remained of his family. But there were people that I know who knew his family. So in the 60s or 50s or 60s, yeah.
Are you also a McGiller, if that's the word?
I think it's a McGillian, but I'm not even sure, actually. I did go there for law school. Yeah, I went there for law school, and they gave me an honorary doctorate a few years ago, which was very nice.
Jeez. So, and undergrad?
Undergrad, I went to a school called Concordia, which is the other school in Montreal. It's sort of a city college. I had the good fortune of going to at a very good program that I went to there, which was a liberal arts college. It's kind of a great books program headed by a brilliant intellectual named Frederick Krantz, who had studied at Columbia, and he created a liberal arts college. And so I had the good fortune to study there for my undergrad.
Hillel, a few times in my life in Q&As like this, when I've been the A rather than the Q, I've been asked, why are you interested in human rights? And why do you care about human rights? And usually I say, I don't know. And then the conversation moves on. Do you know, or is it just too long a thing to get into?
Yeah, no, I think there's an element that we never know. Is it from your parents, your family, your school, people you saw? Certainly, I remember as a youngster going to rallies in -20 minus 25 Celsius. I don't know what the Fahrenheit is, but the freezing cold of Montreal. We used to go, it was in the Soviet Union, had a consulate in Montreal, and there was the struggle for Soviet Jewry. They were, you know, locking up dissidents like Anatoly Sharansky, as he was then known. And there was this man standing on a makeshift stage, or maybe on a rooftop of a car or something, with a bullhorn, and his name was Professor Erwin Kotler. And I was maybe 9 years old, and I would see this person, Professor Kotler, talking about these things. And then when I was a teenager, I would listen to him speak in the community and stuff like that. And then when I went to law school, I studied closely with Professor Kotler, became my mentor. So he's, as you know, is one of the great human rights lawyers of our time. He's defended many of the most prominent dissidents around the world and political prisoners. So he's someone, if I have to, you know, name one influence, certainly he's been an influence on my life. When I studied with him in law school, I took a civil liberties seminar with him. And there were only about 15 of us in the class. And we had to go around the room. And one of the questions we had to answer in one of the workshops was, what will you do when, or what would you do, or what will you do when you're the head of a human rights NGO? And this is when we were all about 24 years old. And I didn't really know why he was asking that question. It's not something that I had really thought about at that time, but you never know what seeds get planted, so.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Jay Nordlinger doing Q&A with Hillel Neuer, the Executive Director of UN Watch, the founding chairman of the Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy. We'll be back after this word from our sponsor, X-Chair. Many of us spend more time every day in our office chair than in our car or bed. That's why it's so important to invest in the right chair. We want to spend those hours with the right level of support and comfort to get the most out of our day. X-Chair will make your time at your desk more productive, yes, but it also may prove your favorite place to sit for any reason. Not only does X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar, or DVL, offer the ultimate customized support, X-Chair can also give you a massage, or heat up or cool down, for real. And now, thanks to X-Chair's new FS360 armrests, you can adjust your armrest to the perfect position just for you. All these unique X-Chair features help the hours at your desk fly by in complete comfort. People love their X-Chairs, and for very good reasons. Go to xchairqa.com now. That's the letter xchairqa.com. Or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. xchairqa.com. Welcome back, everyone, to Q&A. Jay Nordlinger sitting and talking with Hillel Neuer. I'm in New York. He is often in Geneva, where he lives and works. He is in Jerusalem today. Hillel, what is UN Watch? The word watch implies a kind of monitor.
Yes, indeed, yeah. We are, I guess, the only organization in the world that was founded with specific mission to monitor the United Nations according to the principles of its charter. And it's important to say a word about our founder. Our founder was a great American named Morris Abram. He was a civil rights leader from way back in the early mid-50s, before it was very popular in America. He was a Jew who grew up in Georgia. He had, as a young lawyer, he worked
That's the U.S. state of Georgia.
That's correct. That's right. Yeah. U.S. state of Georgia.
I remember he spoke with a Southern accent. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Fitzgerald, Georgia, which now has a giant mural. Recent years, he was sort of rediscovered, and they painted a giant mural in his honor and describing his life. And he spent some time in the Nuremberg tribunals after World War II that prosecuted Nazi war criminals. I think he worked with Justice Robert Jackson, I believe. Then he went back to Georgia, and he ended up becoming close with the family of Martin Luther King. He was friendly with Daddy King, Martin Luther King's father, and he was helping get Martin Luther King out of prison. He was a go-between with the Kennedy family. And already by the early 60s, Morris Abram was a very prominent civil rights leader. When they had a civil rights conference in 1965, there's a photo of about four or five African-Americans, including Martin Luther King and other luminaries, And the only person who's not African-American in the photo is Morris Abram. So he was head of the United Negro College Fund and many other important causes and served American presidents in many ways. By the mid-60s, he was the US delegate to the Human Rights Commission, the Commission on Human Rights, that he would sort of fly to Geneva for the sessions. And then in the late 80s, he had remained the same. Democratic Party, he felt, had gone perhaps a bit too much to the left. And so he was actually appointed by Ronald Reagan, it was then George Bush, 1989. He was appointed US ambassador to the United Nations in Europe, which is based in Geneva. That includes the what's today called the Human Rights Council, but also the UN Refugee Agency, the World Health Organization. Many of the other important UN specialized agencies are based in Geneva. Morris Abram was the US ambassador. He dealt with the UN. He felt it was an organization that was necessary for the world, but that it wasn't working properly. And the issues that were important to him were human rights issues, the UN as a whole, the international order, but also Jewish issues. He himself was...
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Had been in the 1960s, head of the American Jewish Committee in a volunteer capacity and involved in the struggle for Soviet Jewry. So as U.S. ambassador, he saw how the United Nations was in many ways not living up to its principles. He supported funding for the U.N., but he wanted it to work. So when he retired in Geneva, he had finished being U.S. ambassador, he had the idea to create a new organization, a non-for-profit organization called U.N. Watch, which would watch the U.N. on the range of issues to hold the U.N. to the U.N. Charter, which is actually a great document of liberal internationalism crafted by the brain trust of FDR in, you know, the latter years of World War II. And so it's to hold the UN to the UN Charter with a particular focus on the unequal treatment of Israel and fighting anti-Semitism, which were issues that were important to him. And so today, this we're now about 30 years later, it was founded in 1993. We continue to be a leading organization holding the UN to account, promoting and protecting human rights in a place which often appoints dictators to high office, and speaking out against anti-Semitism and the demonization of Israel, which is a very common phenomenon, certainly at the Human Rights Council, but also at other UN bodies.
Mm. Well, Hillel, by the way, if I'm ever elected president, you will certainly be the U.S. ambassador in Geneva for human rights. I wouldn't wait up nights. Don't plan your whole future around it, but I will do my best. But you would be among my very first nominees for anything.
Thank you, Jay.
You have also the Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy. I have to say that certainly where I live, the word democracy has been in bad odor lately. People have turned against it. Oh, we're not a democracy, we're a republic and so on. A democracy is terribly problematic. It was always a golden word when I was growing up. You know, Tocqueville, Democracy in America. Reagan inspired the National Endowment for Democracy. You know, it stems from his great Westminster speech in, I believe, June 1982. But a lot of people these days, again, certainly where I live on the right, turn up their nose at democracy. You don't. What do you mean by democracy?
Well, for me, democracy means liberal democracy, obviously, in the best sense of the term. It means a democracy which is a country that has free and fair elections, that has majoritarianism, that works by majority vote, and something that many countries around the world don't have. And if a government is oppressing its people or is corrupt, then there is a system that you can, a system of free and fair elections that you can elect the other guy, the other woman. And, you know, that's number one. And I said liberal democracy, and that means it's not only majoritarianism. If the majority votes to, throw one of the minorities into the sea, if it's a boat and the majority votes that we're gonna throw the guy in the yellow shirt into the ocean, it's not just a majority, it's a liberal democracy. And I also believe in the principles of counter-majoritarianism, where you have a constitution, and if someone is violating the basic principles of the system, then a government decision or a law that is in breach of the constitution can be struck down, and that is a counter-majoritarian act. And of course, how you find the balance is something the United States has been struggling with maybe for 200 years. But essentially, when I mean liberal democracy, and I imagine the best forms that we've come up with in Western democracies in the past, let's say, century or two. Yeah.
Hillel, I've noticed in my life, and surely you have too, that people tend to be selective about human rights. Very few, I find, are the people who favor or support human rights across the board. I'm just generalizing now, but when I was growing up and coming of age, people around me cared a lot about human rights in Chile, the Philippines, and above all, apartheid South Africa. They weren't all that worried about human rights behind the Iron Curtain, for example, or in China, or in Cuba. Today, when I write about human rights in Cuba, Venezuela, Iran, a lot of people applaud. Those same people don't tend to applaud when I write about human rights in Saudi Arabia, Russia, other countries. I imagine that you in your career have run into this business of selectivity, but I'll let you say for yourself instead of simply assuming.
Yes, no, you're quite right. And you describe a phenomenon, I guess, which is going back maybe 50 years. And
yes, that's right.
Many of us like to say we support human rights and or other principles in society. And then when you see how they're applied, you know, we're speaking about human rights, but you could talk about the rule of law or pick other principles that people of different political persuasions will say, perhaps with sincerity, that they support. But in fact, if you look how they apply it, one may question whether it's being applied fairly and non-selectively. So I think that's typically a fair criticism across the board. And the world of human rights that I inhabit is close to the UN. It's in some ways centered around the UN. And that is a world that is predominantly left-leaning, to put it mildly, if not on the far left. So, for example, something interesting is that there are, in Geneva at the UN Human Rights Council, there are about 55 mandates where you have a monitor who was appointed. It's called a UN independent expert or a special rapporteur or a working group. These are either one individual or a group of five individuals who are appointed to monitor a particular right. For example, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, torture, arbitrary detention, and so forth. And there's a number of them that are there to implement civil and political rights that are the classic rights that are known to Americans. There's a whole slew of rights that are social and economic rights as defined by the UN, which would be foreign to the classical understanding in America. Things like the right to food and the right to water and the expert against toxic waste and on the environment and all those sorts of things. But what's interesting is that in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, one of the fundamental rights that is mentioned there is the right to property. There is no special rapporteur on the right to property. There is a special rapporteur on dozens of economic and social rights that many people have never even heard of, but which have been created by the UN. But there's no special rapporteur to defend the right to property, which is a very important right. And we know that in those regimes that have run roughshod over the classical civil rights or things like whether it's censorship or torture or violations of freedom of assembly, we know that they're historically connected to the same regimes that the first thing they do is to take away your property rights, and they're intimately connected. But that is not, property rights are not seen as important by the human rights industry surrounding the UN. They're the ones who lobby for the creation of these mandates. And I've never heard anyone stand up and say, wait a minute, this is rather odd. It's one of the important rights listed in this 1948 declaration that was championed by Eleanor Roosevelt, right to property. You never hear it. And why is that? Well, for reasons that you described, that many of the these human rights groups like Amnesty International and others are not so sympathetic to the right to property and don't mind that much when Hugo Chavez was walking around Caracas and pointing at buildings and saying, we're on camera saying, we're gonna nationalize that one, we're gonna take that one, we're gonna take that one. And it starts with buildings, and then you put people and judges and human rights activists and students and political opposition leaders in prison. So it's just one example on how the ideological bent very much colors the way people see human rights. And again, the criticism I'm sure could apply on both sides, but the human rights industry today is dominated by groups that are either left or very far left. People who would, in the UK, for example, would be in the camp of Jeremy Corbyn. Those are the same people who are running most of the human rights NGOs.
Yep, pretty foul stuff in my book. Hillel, here's an old question. I've written about it, I don't know, a dozen times over the years. And you would think I would have an answer, and I really don't. It depends on the day, my mood, how I've gotten out of bed. The question is this, and it concerns the United States and the UN. Should the United States belong to the UN Human Rights Council, whatever it happens to be called in a given period, in order to defend human rights properly, to work for reform within? Or should the US say, screw it, you people are irredeemable, we're not going to have anything to do with it, you're not going to have anything like our blessing or imprimatur. If you just want to be sort of an anti-Israel playground, go ahead, but you can play without us. Sometimes that's my disposition. At other times, my disposition is, no, get in there and fight. Don't leave the field to the bad actors. Weigh in and use all the weight you possibly can. What I think today, I don't know. I'd have to consult myself. What do you think?
Yeah, well, you've aptly described what has been, I would say, the debate in Washington for the past, say, 20 years concerning the Human Rights Commission, which is now called the Human Rights Council since 2006. And I don't think there's an easy answer. I too, as someone who has basically lived there for the past 18 years, and I am the most hated man at the Human Rights Council in ways that some
high
people
praise,
know.
High praise.
Yes, in ways that some people may know from reading our stuff and seeing the videos where I'm interrupted, but there's a whole bunch of other things, Jay, which I haven't yet published, and I probably will in the near future, about the way they try to shut me down and conspire against me. It's very unpleasant. But so as someone who's personally been wronged by this machine in very bad ways, certainly there are times when personally and because of the issues, where I felt, good golly, let's just let them stew in their own juices. But essentially, I think it's wrong. I think the position that you described with having America there to fight is necessary. And let me explain it. The critics say, typically from on the conservative side in America, they say this place is rotten. They look at the current membership and they rightly say that 2/3 of the current membership are either outright dictatorships or or non-democracy. So it means the current members of the Human Rights Council include China, Cuba, Libya, Eritrea, Pakistan, Somalia, Venezuela, the list goes on. Russia was almost always a member. Because of the Ukraine invasion, we called for them to be removed, and the Americans ran with it and they removed them. And but that's the exception. So two-thirds are non-democracies, with many of them being outright dictatorships. And you know, you put rotten ingredients in the soup and you get a rotten soup. And so the criticism, as you said, is you know, this is a body that has one agenda item on the world and one agenda item on Israel. Whenever there's a war with Hamas and Israel, they basically pass resolutions and create commissions of inquiry that empower terrorists. And Hamas cheers on the Human Rights Council's resolutions. Hamas terrorist group cheers on their commissions of inquiry. It's rather absurd and very nasty stuff. So the criticism is, as you said, we shouldn't be legitimizing it for a moment. We shouldn't be giving it our imprimatur, and we should walk away. The problem is, well, it's been tried, right? In 2006, when they had this giant reform where they scrapped the old discredited Human Rights Commission and they created in its place the new and improved, we were told, Human Rights Council. George W. Bush, then the president, and John Bolton, the US ambassador, they said, sorry, we, in the words of John Bolton, you can't put lipstick on a caterpillar and call it a butterfly. We're not joining this new Human Rights Council. So America did not join. It was the first time since 1948. Well, it was created actually in 1946. Eleanor Roosevelt was the founding chair. And it was the first time since 1946 that America was not on the council, except for 1 year after the Iraq War, when they didn't get elected for 1 year. But basically, America was on forever. And this is the first time America decided not to join. I was there. And I was there when America left. And Jay, if I have to summarize what it was like, because it was bad before, but it was much worse when America left. And it reminded me when I was in elementary school in second grade, when the teacher would leave for, we were about 20 kids in the class, the teacher would leave the class for a few minutes to go to the bathroom or whatever, and appoint one of the kids as the monitor, chalk would be thrown and there'd be mayhem. That's what it was like. I saw what the world looked like when the United States left the room. It was mayhem. Pakistan and Egypt at the time were very powerful. Pakistan was often heading the Islamic group of states, which is 56 states. Egypt was leading the Arab group. You had Algeria was maybe leading the African groups, the nasty guy named Idris Al-Jazari, who had studied in the Sorbonne and at Harvard, and I think maybe at Oxford. And he used his brilliant English and education to attack human rights. And all these bad guys were empowered. And the Europeans, they were accustomed to following America. America was the leader. When America would introduce a resolution on China back in 2003, it wouldn't pass, but it would be introduced, and America would often ask, I don't know, the Czechs to do it. America was the leader. And, you know, sadly in my lifetime at the UN, I remember when America was the leader of the free world. And in recent years, you see the rise of China and other countries, and America now is weak and confused, and it's sad. But I saw what happened when America left the room. Now, in America, the conservative voices will say, we've left the Human Rights Council. We're turning off the TV, so to speak, turning off the monitor from that entity, and we're moving on. Guess what? It continues to. You may have turned off the channel. You may have changed the channel. You may have turned off your screen, but it continues. And it is, for human rights activists around the world, considered the temple of human rights. For foreign ministries around the world, the resolutions of the Human Rights Council sit on their shelves. It influences whether we like it or not. Whether it's a nasty place or not, it influences the hearts and minds of hundreds of millions of people around the world, translated into every language. And when America wasn't there, it got worse and they did bad things and it didn't go away. So if one could make the case that it would go away, perhaps in the end, you know, on the ledger of pros and cons, maybe we'd be ahead, but it's not going away. And they're going to empower China, empower Cuba, empower Iran, demonize Israel. And I think, to me, it's rather straightforward that the ideal would be Patrick Moynihan, 1975, when the UN under Idi Amin and the Soviets said Zionism is racism, he stood up and delivered what is probably the most brilliant speech, the most intellectual speech ever delivered at the United Nations, when he talked about language and ideas and words and the meaning of words And I recommend anyone who cares can look up the Patrick Moynihan speech from 1975. It's on our website and it's on YouTube. And, you know, I thought, and I think conservatives thought, critics of the UN thought it was great when Patrick Moynihan, you know, spoke truth to power in the General Assembly. America does not have a veto in the General Assembly. America lost that vote and lost other votes in the 70s, but he spoke out in defense of civilization. And you know, I'm there at, on behalf of a small NGO and I can speak out, but the journalists don't have to cover me and they can ignore us if they want to. But when the United States speaks, the world can't ignore it. They can outvote them, but they can't ignore it. So to me, my ideal is seeing, is as I said, Patrick Moynihan there, Jean Kirkpatrick, who was a member of our board in the 1990s, her speaking out, seeing Nikki Haley when she spoke out brilliantly. And so I think actually conservatives who think very highly of the individuals I just mentioned, who served under Republican administrations, whether each of them was always a Republican is not necessarily the case. But I think we value very much their role and representing the United States. And in my opinion, representing civilization, defending the principles of democracy and human rights and basic fairness in this world forum and going on record in a powerful way. So that's what I'd like to see. The problem, Jay, is that we've kind of had something else. Those who champion engagement in the past 15 years, let's say the Obama administration, and now the Biden administration, when they join, they're not joining to be Patrick Moynihan. They're not joining the Human Rights Council to be Jean Kirkpatrick, and they're not joining it to be Nikki Haley. They're joining it to be, you know, the ambassadors of a different kind, of Samantha Power, who didn't like criticizing the UN. When she was getting confirmed at the Senate, she said, my hero is Jean Kirkpatrick and Patrick Moynihan, okay, which was rather amusing, but that's what the Republican senators were very here, and they confirmed her. But when she first day showed up at the UN, she said, I love the UN, let me count the ways how much I love the UN. So unfortunately, when the US joins the Human Rights Council under, whether it's Obama or Biden, under the Democratic administrations in recent years, not necessarily in the past, but in recent years, they've seen their role as defenders of the UN and have been hesitant, generally hesitant to criticize the UN. And just to finish on this point, the Human Rights Council meets three times a year, September, March, and June. At the end of every session, the Obama administration would have, and the Biden administration has continued this now that they've rejoined the Human Rights Council, they have a publication they put out, a statement on the State Department website called Key Outcomes of the Last Session. And basically they become cheerleaders. So terrible things may happen and they don't like to talk about it. So that's the problem that we have. We either have the Republicans are gone and bad things are happening and no one's standing up for it, or the Democrats join. And yes, they typically vote the right way, but they're hesitant to speak out.
Well, so. Hello, I'll tell you something that may make you smile. I'm a Boltonian through and through, but I'm also a Neuerite. So, you know, I contain multitudes, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, I hear you entirely.
Yeah.
Hillel, do you know who Lou Cannon is?
Remind me. I know the name.
Old friend of mine, a great and legendary political reporter, and probably the chief biographer of Reagan. And he's about 90 now. He's writing his memoirs, and I was visiting him recently and writing about him. And he grew up in Reno, Nevada. And when the Soviets invaded Finland in November 1939, he was six. And his parents had a Finnish neighbor and friend. And Lou Cannon, age six, was intensely interested in this war, the Winter War, as it would be known. He was following it, I guess, on the radio. And you know, rooting for the Finns heartily. Now it's in 2022, and he told me, I'm following the Ukraine war obsessively, every twist and turn. I'm consumed by it. Reminds me a bit of that prior situation, he says. And I'm consumed by it too. I guess I'm a little surprised that others aren't. I mean, the world goes on, people have work to do, they have daily concerns. But what Vladimir Putin's Russia is doing to Ukrainians is satanic. And I'm not sure why it's not a bigger deal than it is in the world. Talk about this in whatever way you like. Talk about Russia and Ukraine.
Well, we were warned. I'll say that, of course. Our one of our advisory board members is a man named Garry Kasparov. For those who don't know him, he was a Russian chess grandmaster, a world champion in chess, and then in his later years became a Russian dissident. You know him quite well. But he, for the past 20 years, has been a leading Russian dissident and eventually had to flee Russia because he realized he was going to wind up in prison. And he was warning us for years, and his book was Winter is Coming. And so we were warned and we didn't want to see it. We were told about the reset button, and when there was one person who took the floor publicly to call out Russia, it was Mitt Romney, and he was mocked by Obama at the time and said, you know, the 1980s called, they want their foreign policy back. So in one sense, we were warned that we didn't want to see it. And I live in Europe, and Europe is afraid that the radiator is going to go off if they stop buying Russian oil. And I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump, but he called out Germany on this. And on that point, he was right. So in some sense, we were warned about a lot of things and we didn't want to see it. And it's the Europeans and the Americans too. We didn't want to, and you can bring up different, you know, I mentioned Romney, but of course, you know, George W. Bush looked into Putin's soul and thought he saw good things. And we didn't want to see it. And we allowed Russia to become so powerful. And you know, I'm sitting at the Human Rights Council and Russia gets elected time and time again. And then I'm told by European diplomats that, oh no, you know, we need different kinds of countries to be at the Human Rights Council because that's where they'll learn and improve. And I once gave a speech in 90 seconds and I said, you know, in the past 10 years, because if you ask European diplomats, they'll tell you that, yeah, we need, you know, if you ask them, how is it that China and Saudi Arabia got elected to the Human Rights Council, and why is Iran on the Women's Rights Commission? And the Swedish foreign minister, her last name is escaping me right now. So she said, she literally said, oh no, we you know, what would the Women's Rights Commission be like if it was just you know, Sweden and Norway? And we need to have countries like Saudi Arabia on, so she said, so they'll learn and improve. So I asked at the Human Rights Council, said, you know, since Vladimir Putin's Russia and Chavez and Maduro Venezuela and Xi Jinping's China were elected time and time again to the Human Rights Council, did they learn and improve? Of course, they didn't. They only invaded more countries, attacked more dissidents, arrested more human rights activists than ever before. So with Russia, the world knew but didn't want to see it. People were being poisoned. Our friend Vladimir Karamurza, someone I had the privilege to bring to the UN a number of times and just got to have his wife, and I know that you interviewed her recently, Evgenia Karamurza, and she's fighting for the freedom of her husband. He warned the world. We went to the United Nations a couple of years ago when Russia was running for the Human Rights Council, and he said, you can't elect this country, and nobody wanted to hear about it. And so in one sense, we were warned, and even on Ukraine, this is really a new part of the war. The first invasion began in 2014. But obviously what we're seeing is mass killing of a scale that we haven't seen in continental Europe in many decades. And it should shock the conscience of mankind. And I don't have a good answer for you of why it doesn't. I guess most of us in the world have a hard time being in shock. I think people were in shock at the beginning. And just like the Syrian killings, maybe 500,000 people have been killed in the past 11 years. And initially we were shocked. Initially, even at the Human Rights Council, there were emergency sessions because the Arab world turned on Syria, the Islamic world turned on Syria at the time. But over time, you know, that's over. And now Assad is being invited back. So our tolerance for killing apparently is rather large. And you have this strange thing in the United States where for some very bizarre reason, you have people in the Republican Party who want to see good things about Putin. And he's not a good Christian. He's not a good Christian. He's not a good European. He's murdering Christians. And anyone who believes otherwise is is really betraying.
Delusional or malicious.
Yes. Yes. So that's a very scary thing to see in the United States, but yeah.
Let's end more brightly. You admire Irving Kotler, great man. You admire Natan Sharansky, great man. Who else? Who are the other big and beneficent figures? People who have meant something to you, meant something to your causes. Do you have a pantheon?
I'm sure there is a pantheon.
And after a few hours, we could think of them. I know this is Bill Buckley would say that this question's like Peking duck, requires 24 hours notice.
Right.
But, you know, Kotler and Sharansky, you know, Kasparov.
Look, you mentioned that I chair an annual event called the Geneva Summit, which is comparable to an event where I see you attending, which is the Oslo Freedom Forum. Our event is held at the Human Rights Council, across the street from the Human Rights Council. And for the past, and we often invite many of the same types of people. So you know the dissidents. So since 2009, it's now about 14 years, we've been inviting incredible people who have put their lives on the line, their liberty on the line, to fight for basic human rights and democracy. So I've met people who've inspired me. When I received the doctorate at McGill, I mentioned a few of them. I mentioned Rosa Maria Paya from Cuba, whose father was the Nelson Mandela of Cuba, the Václav Havel of Cuba, and died a mysterious death. And she and her family, many others, believe that he was killed by the regime. In Miami, they just named a street after Oswaldo Paya. He was a great man. So his daughter is fighting to continue his legacy and is fighting for freedom in Cuba. And she's someone who inspires me. One of the most amazing human rights activists that I've met is Masih Alinejad.
Dynamo.
Her energy, her charisma, her intelligence, her sense of humor, her creativity. She is a small woman who is feared like no one else by the murderous mullahs in Tehran. They fear her and they attack her. And, you know, they tried to kidnap her, according to an indictment that was filed in the United States. They tried to kidnap her and take her to Venezuela and Iran. So Masih Alinejad is in my mind, one of the great dissidents that we see in the world today. Those are some names. Also, you know, Vladimir Karamurza, again, a brilliant, inspiring, dedicated man who was poisoned twice. And I'm sure you mentioned it recently on your show, but I have to mention someone who was poisoned twice because he spoke out against Vladimir Putin in Moscow. And yet, like Navalny, he went back knowing what his fate would be. He spoke out against the war in Ukraine. They came to take him away like a book in Kafka in the trial. And he's taken away. He's behind bars. And I gave instructions to my colleague that every day there has to be at least one tweet for Vladimir Karamurza. We mustn't forget him. That's what I learned from Irwin Kotler. It's what I learned from Yang Jianli, who's also on our advisory board. Yang Jianli is an incredible Chinese dissident who's about 5 years in prison in isolation. He said that when a couple of years after the fact that a lawyer came to visit him and said that there are all these letters that have brought him, all these letters that were sent by people around the world, suddenly he could stand up straight, his back, the fact that people didn't forget him. So that's what we know from the political prisoners. And that's why for Vladimir Karamurza and the others who are in prison, people who are in prison in Iran, in Belarus, in Cuba, in Venezuela, we mustn't forget them. And so those who put their lives on the line, like Masih Alinejad, like Vladimir Karamurza, are to me really inspiring people. And even though I deal with so much nasty, cynical stuff at the Human Rights Council, which is an Orwellian world where they put dictators as the champions of human rights. When I get to sit with Yang Jianli, who sat in Chinese prison for 5 years and who was in America, he was studying at Berkeley and at Harvard, he went back to China and took the risks. You meet people who really put everything on the line for their beliefs. Those are the people who inspire me.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Jay Nordlinger doing Q&A, which is produced by Madeline Osborne. Our sponsor is X-Chair. We've been listening to Hillel Neuer, N-E-U-E-R, the executive director of UN Watch. Thanks a million, Hillel. I admire you tremendously. Strength to your hands.
Thank you. Likewise, I'm a tremendous admirer of basically everything that you write. So keep going. It means a lot. You're one of the principal voices out there.
So long, everyone. Till next time.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.